I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. It's the one-year anniversary of the election of Donald Trump. 3 days after that election, New York Times columnist David Brooks wrote, quote, "The guy will probably resign or be impeached within a year." Well, didn't happen. In fact, in 4 special elections since his inauguration, Democrats were rebuffed in their attempts to galvanize anti-Trump supporters. But then last night happened. E.J. Dion of The Washington Post and Norm Ornstein of The Atlantic join me to talk about what Democratic gains in state and local elections yesterday might mean for the 2018 midterms. Their new book is called One Nation After Trump, in which they ask us to restore a sense of dignity and majesty in self-government. Can Trump's vulgar nationalism be transformed into a new patriotism? E.J. Dion and Norm Ornstein, they're coming up next on Midday, right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. You know, in jurisdictions throughout Maryland and New Jersey and in Virginia, Democrats picked up wins in mayor's offices, governor's mansions, and state houses. In Annapolis, progressive Democrat Gavin Buckley beat incumbent Republican Mayor Michael Pantelidis by a 2-to-1 margin, and the Dems now control 7 of the 8 seats on the Annapolis City Council. Frederick Democratic Alderman Michael O'Connor surprised 2-term Republican Mayor Randy McClement with a resounding win as Democrats swept all 5 seats on the Frederick Board of Aldermen. New Jersey will have a Democratic governor as the current lieutenant governor could not shake the ball and chain that Chris Christie has become. All 3 statewide offices went to Democrats in Virginia. Justin Fairfax will be the Commonwealth's lieutenant governor and the first African-American elected statewide since 1989. And the balance of power in the Virginia House has changed dramatically. It will include at least 14 new Democrats, including its first openly transgender delegate. That number could increase as races for 6 seats in the Virginia House are still too close to call. At the top of the Virginia ticket, Democratic Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam walloped former RNC chair Ed Gillespie by 9 points in a race that many around the country saw as a referendum on the presidency of Donald Trump. It was on this day, November 8th, 1 year ago, that Trump shocked the world when he completed his transition from campaign joke to president-elect. We are marking that anniversary today by having a conversation with E.J. Dion and Norman Ornstein, 2 of America's most astute and highly respected political observers, who are also the authors of a persuasive and insightful new book. The book is called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. They wrote it with Thomas Mann of the University of California and the Brookings Institution. E.J. Dion is a senior fellow at Brookings and a syndicated columnist with the Washington Post. Norman Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a contributing columnist and editor at The Atlantic and the National Journal. They join us from a studio at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. It's good to talk to you.
Great to be with you.
A joy always to be with you, Tom.
So, E.J., let me start with you. What do you make of the results, for example, in Virginia? This is a resounding win for Ralph Northam. A rough campaign, a nasty campaign, certainly in the last few weeks. But the Dems came out quite the bit on top.
How about the Trump era is over, even though he's still in office? I think that the Virginia race was extraordinary in a number of respects. First, it wasn't just that Ralph Northam won, and it wasn't just that Democrats took all 3 of the seats, the offices at the top of the ticket, governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general. It's that they made gains in a gerrymandered House of Delegates that no one, including Governor Terry McAuliffe, a Democrat who was campaigning hard for them, expected Democrats to make. You went through the list of races in Maryland, and those results were replicated all across the country for the Democrats, from Maine to Washington State, down to Georgia, to New York, to Connecticut. This was a massive rebuke to Trump. And in Virginia, you saw it in the exit polls, where many more voters said they were casting their ballots, over a third, to rebuke Trump than said they were casting them to support Trump. I think this is a very powerful signal the voters are sending. And the other thing that's important, you know, one of the core arguments of our book is that the election of Trump has mobilized an extraordinary opposition to him. It's sent people back into politics. It's sent people back to voting. It's energized civil society groups. And you saw that on Election Day. Northam got more votes than anyone has ever gotten in a Virginia governor's race. That's because the sentiment against Trump is so strong that people actually turned out to vote. And that's the biggest harbinger for what might happen in the 2018 elections. And it's the thing the Republicans have to most worry about.
And Norm Ornstein, did this prove perhaps that Trumpism without Trump himself isn't going to be such an easy path to walk down? I mean, perhaps it's analogous to the Democrats losing after his two terms were up, that, you know, charismatic figure of President Obama, that nobody else was able to be Obama. Is it possible that, you know, people are finding that simply nobody else can be Trump? He is a singular figure.
Yeah, I think it's even more than that, though. You know, Ed Gillespie, the Republican candidate for governor, who had been the chairman of the Republican National Committee, who at a time in the past had supported a pro-immigration policy, said that sanctuary cities were not a bad thing to do, ran a really vile campaign at the end, really decided to try to be Trumpist. And Trump was quite enthusiastic about that, as were many of the people in the alt-right. This is a stunning rebuke, but it's a rebuke that suggests that Trumpism with Trump is not going to be very helpful either. And now we have a couple of questions. I do think EJ is absolutely spot on. And one other element of that's positive for Democrats and the country, I would say, is many of those winners in the Virginia Assembly are women. There's just been this stunning surge in women candidates around the country that we're going to see continue. And it's going to, I think, be a very positive thing in the legislatures around the country. But what we also know is that Ed Gillespie, for all of that, got more votes than he got the last time that he ran, which was a very close race for the Senate against the widely respected Mark Warner. So Republicans are still, in many cases, rallying to their tribal identity. This was, though, a rebuke by some especially educated people in the Washington suburbs against everything that Trump represents. And it was this surge in support, this intensity of a reaction against Trump, not just Trumpism. I think that this was a rebuke directly of Trump that Republicans in Congress and elsewhere are going to have to take into account.
And EJ, in your book, you talk about how Democrats need not only tactics and strategy, but also a vision. So when you see wins like Philip Murphy, the progressive former Goldman Sachs executive, just annihilating the current lieutenant governor of New Jersey in that race, when you see the voters of Maine, for example, voting in a referendum to expand Medicaid over the governor's objection, the Republican governor's objection, when you see county executives' seats in New York, Westchester and Nassau County flipping from Republican to Democrats. Is this an indication not just that people are rejecting Trump, but that Democrats are beginning to formulate a vision that's going to make sense to voters?
One of the purposes of our book is to lay out what we think progressives, and we'd like to think even some of the anti-Trump conservatives, could rally to. And so I think there's more work to do on the Democratic side. But I think what was really striking about yesterday and what the Democrats should really pay attention to is that their candidates from all across the ideological spectrum prevailed because they were promising a new direction. If you look at Virginia, the victors sort of spanned the spectrum from Northam, who is quite a moderate figure, to a member of Democratic Socialists of America who won a legislative seat, and everybody in between. And so I think the first thing, Democrats should have vigorous discussions about what they stand for, and we try to promote that in the book. And we do think that they need answers on the economy, growing inequality, and bringing together the entire a working class African American and Latino, as well as the white working class. But above all, they need to, they'd be fools if they descended into ideological infighting right now. The first thing the country is demanding, if you judge from all of these elections, is this new political direction. And I think for now, the most important thing they can do is to declare that Trump really is a danger to democratic values and decent government, and that they are prepared to take up the mantle of opposing him. And as they do that, they need to work out a longer-term vision.
Let me amplify on that, though, Tom. I think one of the huge mistakes that Republicans made was for 8 years they united very consciously in opposition to everything that Barack Obama and Democrats stood for, and never spent a nanosecond coming up with alternatives of their own. Almost 8 years ago, Eric Cantor, who was then the number two Republican leader in the House, said, "Our alternative to Obamacare is weeks away." 400 weeks later, they did not have an alternative. And much of the reaction in Virginia, we know from the surveys, was against the way they'd handled health care. Democrats need to do just as EJ said, but they have to be ready when they can govern again with a coherent program. And it doesn't have to be a program that involves deep ideological disputes between the far left and the left, or even the left and the center. There are things that should unite people and can actually get some support across the lines and be ready to govern. If they do what Republicans have done, and they're doing it on taxes now too, here's another one where they're just trying to slap something together, and what they're doing is horrific. Democrats need to spend some time looking at some of the ideas that we put there in the last half of our book.
Fortunately for our book, I agree entirely with my co-author.
That is convenient, isn't it? Yes.
Yes, it is.
Well, EJ, you know, you write in the book that the special elections that took place post-inauguration when Trump plucked some folks from Congress to serve in his administration, there was one in Kansas, Montana, Georgia, South Carolina. You said that they augured well for the 2018 midterms. That struck me as a somewhat contrary narrative, because an awful lot of people thought, you know, in races like the Georgia race, in which this young man, John Ossoff, raised $23 million in the most expensive congressional campaign ever and couldn't beat what everybody described as a pretty mediocre candidate in Karen Handel, who now has a seat in Congress.
Now a mediocre member of Congress.
Yeah, yeah, right. And so I mean, does this in fact show, I mean, the number of candidates that Democrats are putting forward and the excitement, certainly the turnout, has got to make Democrats feel very happy, because folks often sit out these midterm elections, and they didn't last night.
Well, fortunately, I want to say I'm glad you asked that question, which Richard Nixon used to say but didn't mean, and I actually mean, because the point in our book, I think, was ratified yesterday. When people looked at those special elections, they overlooked the fact that, A, they were in very Republican districts, but more importantly, you saw enormous shifts away from the Republicans. I remember looking at one of the races where, if you looked at Republican counties in that district, the Republican turnout was way down, and the Democratic turnout was up quite a bit. So I think those four races actually prefigured what happened yesterday. Once you move the terrain of battle out of extremely Republican areas and into more competitive areas. The other thing you've seen this year, even before Tuesday, were a whole series of Democratic victories in state legislative races around the country that didn't get much attention. And this shouldn't surprise us. Trump's numbers in the polls are down to, you know, the 30s in many polls. You know, he's sort of bounced around lately from like 33% to 38% approval. That means the vast majority of Americans are very, very unhappy with him. And so I think that we should have looked at those elections, and that's what we argued in the book, as a sign of this level of dissatisfaction with him.
Now, there's another couple of elements here that are worth considering. Something else happened yesterday, which is Frank Labiondo, a moderately conservative in today's context, which means pretty conservative but not radical, Republican congressman from New Jersey announced that he was retiring out of frustration at both parties, but primarily at his own.
And that's a pretty crowded bus when it comes to folks retiring, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. And it's a seat that would have been safe Republican because he had ties to labor and the like, that now becomes, for the Republicans at best, a toss-up. When you get an election like yesterday, we're going to see a wave of retirements. More will come. And that opens up more possibilities for Democrats. Now, what happened in Georgia 6 in part was that there was so much attention paid to this race. Although you had a strong mobilization on the Democratic side, you also had a mobilization on the Republican side. The tribal identities, the negative partisanship that we know is a dominant feature, worked there. The same time, you had a race that went under the radar in the South as well, where the Democrat who didn't have a lot of money came very, very close to winning. And when you get to a midterm with hundreds of contests, you're not going to be able to get that same level of attention to most of them. Democrats have an opportunity here to keep Republicans, who I think are going to continue to be divided and demoralized, from mobilizing in the same way. And if they can keep up that level of intensity that we saw today, then they have a chance to have a true wave election next year.
Norm Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a columnist for the National Journal and the Atlantic. E.J. Dion is with him on the line from Harvard University, where E.J. is a visiting professor this year. He is a longtime columnist for the Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution with Thomas Mann. They are the authors of One Nation After Trump, a guide for the perplexed, the disillusioned, the desperate, and the not yet deported. When we come back from a quick break, were Democratic wins in local and state offices in Maryland and beyond a harbinger of a political upheaval, and will it continue into the 2018 midterm elections? We'll take some of your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org. To follow us on Twitter, we're at Midday Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's Living Questions, our monthly series on religion in the public sphere. Ira Forman is the former U.S. Special Envoy of the Office to Monitor and Combat Anti-Semitism at the State Department. He's going to join me. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will have a review of Origin of the Species at the Strand Theater. If you're just joining us today, we're talking politics and Trumpism on this one-year anniversary of Donald Trump's election with E.J. Dion of the Brookings Institution and the Washington Post and Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute and the Atlantic magazine. With Thomas Mann, they are the authors of One Nation After Trump, a guide for the perplexed, the disillusioned, the desperate, and the not yet deported. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, our phone number, 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org, and to find us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. So, EJ, you call for, the first half of the book is kind of a critique of how we got to where we are with Trump et al. And the second part is a very beautifully and persuasively argued way forward with specific recommendations about what we need to do. You call for a new patriotism, a new civil society, and a new democracy. And you say, one of the things you say is that the task for the next generation is to show that we can create wealth in ways that allows it to be broadly shared across class and race and region. When has that ever been the case in the United States of America?
Well, first, bless you for those nice words about our book.
I'm a huge fan of this book, you guys. This is a terrific read.
You,
I gotta
thank
tell you.
Thank you so much.
Mention it with every newscast.
we'll see what we can do, Norm.
If we look at the period from the end of World War II until roughly the early 70s, we had a period of very rapid economic growth that was shared right across the economic spectrum, from the lowest income to the highest income. We had a period where people who worked with their hands, who worked in factories, could earn a decent living, could look forward to a time when their kids would go to college. And this was a bipartisan period. It, you know, it started with Truman, it went to Ike, and then it went to JFK and LBJ, and even parts of the early Nixon years. And what we were committed to as a country was the idea that we do have a market economy. You know, we honor people who invest and build companies and the like, but we also honor working people and their contribution. And we have laws and rules that allowed people who were not at the top to have equal bargaining power. We also had tax laws that were considerably more progressive. For a whole series of reasons that I won't sort of take up a lot of time with now, but having to do with changes in the global economy, the fact that new entrants in the global economy were there, and most recently China, this changed. And the economic discontent that Trump exploited in the last election is real. The costs of deindustrialization began in the inner city, as William J. Wilson, the great sociologist here, wrote in his book, When Work Disappears. If you looked at the situation of African Americans in the inner city, the loss of these manufacturing jobs put a real dent in the living standards of African Americans. Now that phenomenon has spread to areas that are predominantly white and working class, like Reading, Pennsylvania, or Erie, Pennsylvania, to pick a couple of examples. And so what we need to do is to, in a very new circumstance, recreate an economy that will continue to grow, but will grow in ways that that long post-war economy grew, that is, in ways that benefit everybody.
And Norm Ornstein, Donald Trump talked about the forgotten men and women who will be forgotten no more. And people tend to think of those that demo of the voting electorate as the white so-called working class people who have been disillusioned with both parties. You mentioned that Father Andrew Greeley refers to some of these folks as neighborhood people. These are not people who whose aspiration is to become a citizen of the world. They like this, as you say, the particular patch where they were raised. And you talk about finding new ways of talking to each other, this incredible bifurcation in the body politic here between the right and the left and certainly the Trump contingent of the Republican Party and the progressive left. How do we do that? I mean, there's a school of thought that says trying to convince the Trump voter that she made a mistake is futile, and what we simply need to do is replace her with five new pro-Democrat voters.
It's not an easy thing to do. And, you know, a couple of points to make here. One is, as you know, we have a chapter on Trump, the phony populist. He talked about the forgotten men and women, and he's forgotten them in the healthcare policies, in the tax policies, in a whole host of other ways. And, you know, we use a word in the book frequently, and this is from EJ, empathy. And, you know, it can be a hokey word in a sense, but I think it's very important here. And one of the tricky parts is there are evil people out there. There are people who have deliberately exploited racist, anti-Semitic, and other deeply divisive elements in the society. I'd put Steve Bannon in that category, and there are many others, and they ought to be condemned and condemned in harsh terms. But it really is the case that a lot of those neighborhood people voted the way they did because of a sense of despair in their lives and a pessimism about the future for their children and for future generations. And there are real reasons why people can vote for those whose policies otherwise might be anathema. You know, I had some serious objections to the famous book, What's the Matter with Kansas? Because in a sense, there was a kind of an arrogance. How can these people be so stupid that they're voting against their own economic interests? If we understand where people are coming from a little bit more, realize that some of the pathologies that we're seeing out there, including the opioid crisis, that are hitting parts of America very different from those African Americans in the cities that William Julius Wilson wrote about. But the same things happen when you face these kinds of stresses. If we can find a way to come up with policies for the working class, not the white working class, because these issues cut across all of those lines. And if we can start to think about people by putting ourselves in their shoes and understanding why they feel the way they do, and then try and work to create a different dialogue, we can be a better America. And I think last night gave us at least some sense of a hope that maybe we can get some traction to do just that.
Could I say something about that? Just on What's the Matter with Kansas, I agree with some of Norm's critique, although it is worth remembering that that book was very insistent that more had to be done for working class people across the board. And I that part of the argument, I think, was entirely valid. But this question of, I have to give a lecture here in tomorrow that I've called Fighting for Justice with an Open Heart. And I think that there are two big problems in our country that kind of clash. There's a tension. On the one hand, we need to speak up right now very forcefully in defense of all those people out there who are African-American, Latino, immigrants, women, who feel under attack. We also need to speak out very forcefully against the autocratic tendencies that we are seeing in President Trump, whether it's in his attacks on the media, his demonization of his opponents, his attacks on the truth itself day to day. We need to be very strong and committed. At the same time, our country is being torn apart right now, and we need to find ways of talking to each other again, which is why we do, and thanks, Norm, for that shout out, we really do need empathy. We need to find ways to say to those who voted the other way for many of us in the last election, we disagree with what you did. We don't think you're going to get out of this what you hope to. And a lot of those people are coming to that conclusion right now. But we totally get your pain and suffering because you're not making that up. And one of the lines in the book that you know, I hope gets some resonance is that we cannot, as a society, hold one group's pain against another group's pain. That is a recipe for endless division. It's also a recipe for doing nothing about the problems facing African Americans or Latinos or white working class people.
Yeah, you suggest make America empathetic again as an alternative to Mr. Trump's infamous campaign slogan. E.J. Dion and Norm Ornstein join me from Boston, or from Cambridge, quite specifically. Their new book is called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. They wrote it with Thomas Mann of the Brookings Institution. And Norm Ornstein, one of the guides, one of the bits of guidance that you suggest in the book is that policies need to be more place-based versus individually oriented. You even suggest that the federal government could help local communities identify the assets that they have that they can build on, some of these rural and exurban communities that are suffering in terms of the manufacturing base slipping away and that sort of thing. First of all, would locals be open to federal help in that way? I mean, would we hear a counter argument to that from the right that says, you know, look, get your hands off of our local communities. We want local control. What sort of assets are we talking about here that can help places turn themselves around?
I think we're still talking about actually what we're talking about in some ways is a new federalism that will get some disapproval on the right because their notion of federalism is when local and state governments do what they want them to do. And when those entities move in a different direction, they're perfectly happy to have the Fed step in and block them from doing so. We saw that, for example, earlier on when it came to Oregon moving towards an assisted suicide program through a referendum. But there are lots of ways in which some federal assistance can give a leg up to communities to act in a fashion that serves their own local interests. And I'll give you one example. I went to a seminar this summer at the Aspen Institute on Communications, and we had a lot of discussion about how you could do a public-private partnership, starting with the Federal Communications Commission, with major internet providers to move high-speed internet into these rural and ex-urban areas, which is absolutely critical if they're going to have any ability to recover economically, and do it in a way that would enable these communities to help serve small businesses and expand the educational and employment opportunities that are available to them. Federal help on apprenticeship programs, some of which are thriving at state and local areas, could help to create jobs where jobs exist and create skills that wouldn't be there otherwise. There are so many ways in which you could go to communities that are suffering and do something that's really important, because the divide we have, not just between red states and blue states, but within the red and blue states, between the thriving metropolitan communities and the stagnant and struggling rural communities, is not something we can allow to just continue. And there are ways to deal with it that are not a sort of, we're going to tell you what to do, but that provide necessary resources to enable those communities to get themselves back on their feet.
And you talk about, EJ, the fact that, you know, for decades now, politics has been a spectator sport. It's rough and tumble. People talk about how it's, you know, it's not beanbag and all that stuff. And we see these, you know, really harsh, vitriolic, divisive ads that appeared at the end of the campaigns in Virginia and even in New Jersey, talking about MS-13. And you've got Mr. Trump tweeting about how Gillespie was going to be the only person in Virginia to restore law and order. That sort of thing. One of the most interesting observations I found, or one of many interesting observations I found in this book, was that the values that spring out of community, and you talk about how community provides the context for intimacy and morality, and it stays as a repository for the old traditions, that those values, where we formerly found them in neighborhood and places of worship and family, they're now being adduced by large-scale organizations. So in a way, we really do need to bring it back to the local level and figure out what we believe as a republic and what our democratic values are.
In fact, if we had a more functional politics, we might actually be able to have some constructive conversation across the lines of left and right, because you know, my conservative friends have spoken for a long time about the importance of civil society and local institutions. And that's something a lot of progressives agree with. What do community organizers do, after all, except organize local communities, often, by the way, in cooperation with local churches? You see that with the Industrial Areas Foundation and PICO and all kinds of other organizing groups. So we are for local action and for reviving these communities. What we talk about in the book is how the economic changes we've seen and the economic inequality we've seen can rip the guts out of a local community in the same way a great flood can also destroy a community. We cite a famous book by a sociologist called Kai Erickson about a flood in West Virginia. Well, now it's a social flood, and that is leading to family breakdown. It is leading to the opioid crisis. And so we need a real conversation about how to restore these institutions of civil society. And then the other thing that you referenced is organizations over the years have tended to be national membership organizations where you send in dues and you count on somebody up there to act. My colleague here at Harvard for this semester, Theda Scotchball, has written powerfully about that. And I think a lot of organizations, as we point out, are now turning to reviving grassroots participation. The ACLU is doing this. A number of other groups are doing this. We need more bottom-up organizations. And Trump has actually helped bring that about on the progressive side. You are seeing organizing to a degree you have not seen for years, and that's a very positive thing.
E.J. Dionne and Norm Ornstein, their new book, which they wrote with Thomas Mann, is called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Norm Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's a contributing editor and a columnist for National Journal and The Atlantic. E.J. Dionne, a longtime columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And this year, he is also a William H. Bloomberg visiting professor at Harvard University. And Professor Dionne, I got to tell you, as we say in Dorchester on the other side of the river, that's wicked. and PISA. It's very cool. Very cool that you're teaching at Harvard.
Well, I'm from Fall River down the road, particularly appreciate that.
All right, more on this terrific book. You can join our conversation. We're going to talk about voting when we come back. It seems an appropriate topic given yesterday's election and the anniversary of last year's election. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's midday. If you've just joined us, I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about a new book by E.J. Dionne, Norm Ornstein, and Thomas Mann. It's called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. It is a clarion call to replace Trump's nationalism with a new patriotism, imbue our public discourse with a new sense of civility, and to refresh our Republican institutions with a renewed sense of our democratic values. E.J. Dionne is a longtime columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Norm Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a columnist for the National Journal and the Atlantic. They join us from a studio at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You are welcome to join us from wherever you are on this one-year anniversary of Donald Trump's election. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Norm and EJ, we have an email here from Susan, a comment. She lives here in Baltimore. She says, the leaders on the left have been too focused on fringe issues like LGBT rights and not focused on things that unite all Americans so that the electorate will come to the left. And we also have a comment from my colleague here at WIPR, Sheila Cast. She mentioned something that I noticed certainly watching the maps on television last night. She says, Virginia's electoral map this morning closely resembles the national map a year ago. Vast swaths of red with some blobs of blue in coastal urban areas. So if Virginia had an electoral college, which of course states don't, Gillespie no doubt would have won. Are Democrats doing anything that will effectively address those swaths of red? And one of the things that you mentioned in this book was a new idea to me. It's something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. So, EJ, you and Norm recommend abolishing the Electoral College. But short of that, there is a movement afoot to use the Electoral College to better or more accurately represent the will of the people. Explain how that would work.
And by the way, Maryland is part of that National Electoral Vote Compact because now Congressman, then State Senator Jamie Raskin, pushed hard for Maryland to join the compact. The idea is very simple, which is that state legislatures who, under the Constitution, actually control the electors in their states if they want. Right now, they delegate the choice of electors to the voters. A group of states would agree that they will cast their electoral votes for the winner of the popular vote in the country as a whole. And there are states, I don't have the number in front of me, but I think it's around 160, Norm?
165.
Yeah, 165 electoral votes are now committed in principle to voting for the winner of the popular vote. What you need, obviously, are 270 electoral votes committed in that way. Now, this is not going to happen anytime soon. You're going to need changes in state legislatures. You're going to need major debates in a lot of other states like the one we had in Maryland. But this is one way to get there, because the difficulty of changing this constitutionally is that the current system vastly overrepresents smaller states who would be unwilling to ratify a constitutional amendment. And if I could just pick on one other problem that we confront, and it's very hard to change under the Constitution. By 2040, 70% of Americans will live in 15 states. That means that by 2040, 70% of Americans will have only 30 senators. That's a real problem for representation. It is, by the way, one reason why sensible gun laws get voted down in the Senate, because states representing rural areas and places where the NRA are strong have outsized voting power. So we have a broad sort of critique of what has become a non-majoritarian democracy, which, when you think about it, isn't really a democracy at all.
Yeah, and you mentioned, Norm Ornstein, that 84% of Americans live in metropolitan areas. We noticed a big divide between metropolitan citizens and rural citizens with the Electoral College. You note that, for example, a Wyoming voter has 3.5 times the electoral power of a California voter. I was actually in Wyoming this summer and was reminded that the population of the entire state of Wyoming is 200,000 fewer people than the city of Baltimore. Yet in the Electoral College, they wield a lot of power. One of the things, Norm, that you talk about is multi-member districts. And that perhaps isn't so hard to change. Congress passed a law not all that long ago, 1967, requiring single-member districts. So what would how would that work, and how would that improve things?
Well, there are different ways of doing it, of course. Some can be more complicated, some more simple. I'm very much attracted to a system that Illinois had in place for many decades. And basically, there were 3 members of their state legislature in a district. And when people went to vote, they cast 3 votes. But they could cast 3 votes for one candidate if they really, really, really liked somebody, 2 for one and 1 for another, or 1 each for 3. And what that system did was it attracted more candidates to run, including more moderate candidates, more with different kinds of talents. And I've talked to a number of people who served in the legislature before that basically went by the boards in the 1960s, and they say that the legislature was much more effective, much less tribal and partisan. And when they went back to the usual system, it's become a model of ineffectiveness. So there are simple ways of doing things that give you a kind of a rank choice, but also provide opportunities for more homogeneous or heterogeneous districts and a wider range of candidates. It's one of the things that can be done without a constitutional amendment. Another thing, just getting back to the Electoral College, I mentioned ranked choice voting, where you vote for your first choice, but also give a second choice or a third choice. We actually do that in a number of cities. Maine now does it for its state representatives as well.
Cambridge, where we are sitting right now, does it in their local elections.
And if states implemented ranked choice voting for president, then the pernicious impact that these third and fourth parties can have, the Jill Steins of the world, the Libertarian parties of the world, and Gary Johnson's, who can tilt an election in a fashion that doesn't necessarily fit the preferences of voters, would go away. Then the people who were voting for a Green Party candidate, for example, who wasn't going to win, when you got down to it, their second choice would go to a candidate who was preferable to them than somebody who might win because those votes were drained away.
And just to underscore that for people out there who like third parties, this system actually empowers them more than the current system, because they would be free to cast their third party vote as their first choice and register that preference, which might actually help the third parties in some races because people would know they weren't throwing their vote away. But what they wouldn't, what they'd also be able to do is to say, when it came down to it, if it's a 3-candidate race, their third choice wouldn't win because they voted for their first choice, and the second choice might be far better for them. So this is a much better way to reflect people's views. Australia uses this system in its national elections, and it creates some real diversity of representation without tilting election results in a kind of random way, which happens with third parties here now.
And you mentioned Australia requires people to vote. If you don't vote in Australia, you are fined financially. And you talk about universal voter registration, which is to say that when you come of age, you are automatically registered to vote unless you opt out. You suggest perhaps pre-registering teenagers at age 16 or 17 when they get their driver's license so that they're teed up and ready to go. Many people have commented on the assault on voting rights and voting, the sort of organized efforts to suppress the vote. There were 14 states in the 2016 election that had new voting restrictions in place. If we required everybody to vote, then it would be the Congress and state legislatures would be compelled to make voting as easy as possible, I guess. Right, Norm?
Yeah. And, you know, in Australia, they don't call it mandatory voting. They call it mandatory attendance at the polls. You have to show up. You can cast a ballot for none of the above. But if you don't show up, the fine is about $15 the first time. And their turnout has gone from levels that were very similar to ours in the 50s to over 90% with every election. Almost every other significant democracy puts the burden for registration to vote on the state and not on the individual. We make it harder for people to vote. There are so many ways in which we can make it easier for them to vote. Yesterday, I was at a press conference promoting the Weekend Voting Act, trying to move Election Day from Tuesday, where it has been since a law by Congress in 1845 that was designed to protect market day back in an agrarian economy. If we voted on Saturdays and Sundays, it would make it easier for people. You know, one of the disturbing elements here, Tom, I have to say, is the Republican Party, which has a demographic challenge as the country becomes more diverse, had two choices. It could move to change its policies or have policies and rhetoric that reflected an attempt to build a broader alliance, to really be competitive at the national level. Or it could move to suppress the votes of those who weren't going to support them otherwise. And by moving so much in that latter direction, they have really damaged, I think, the fundamentals of democracy. And it's a terrible problem that we're going to have to combat very vigorously.
And, you know, EJ, you write that perhaps the results in 2016 were a negative verdict, not necessarily an endorsement of Trumpism. There's probably some argument to be had about that. But some of the other specific suggestions you make, one of them that I found quite interesting, was to change the schedule of Congress. Right now, Congress is in session Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, and they putatively go home on Fridays and come back Monday night. You're saying that perhaps they should make Congress a 9-to-5 job Monday through Friday for 3 weeks each month, giving them the final week to go back home. What would that accomplish?
Well, that is a favorite idea of Norm Ornstein over many, many years, and I want him to explain it. I just want to say one quick thing about voting, which I'm really happy you raised. People talk all the time about how young people don't vote in the same numbers as older people. This voting system we have makes it exceedingly tough on young people who are far more mobile than older people. And it makes it creates all kinds of disincentives for young people to vote. And when you look at voter suppression laws, my favorite is one in Texas where they allowed you to use your gun permit as ID, but did not allow you to use your ID issued at a state university to vote. Now, I wonder what was going on there.
I guess
they were trying to create an incentive to have everybody buy a gun.
Yeah.
But also there was a partisan tilt there. But I want Norm to talk about
the
scheduling.
Well, actually, Norm, my apologies, but we are out of time. So folks are going to have to buy the book and figure it out. But I appreciate both of you guys spending
and
the hour
with us. It makes a great holiday gift, Tom.
It does, doesn't it indeed? And I promise to mention it.
Thanksgiving is coming up.
Thanksgiving. Stuff the turkey. With Norm Ornstein and E.J. Dionne's new book. All right, E.J. Dionne, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a columnist for The Post. He's also a visiting professor at Harvard. Norm Ornstein, the resident scholar at AEI, a resident scholar at AEI and a contributing editor and columnist. The book is called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. They wrote it with Thomas Mann of Brookings. It makes a very well-reasoned and compellingly argued case for a fresh approach to politics and governance. I recommend it very highly. We've got a link to information on our website, wipr.org/midday, but keep it out of the turkey. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Living Questions, our monthly series on religion in the public sphere. Ira Forman He's going to join us. He's the former U.S. Special Envoy of the Office to Monitor and Combat Anti-Semitism at the State Department. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Origin of the Species at the Strand Theater. Lunch today was provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Tomorrow night, 6:30, they're offering a class in vegetarian Vietnamese street food. More on the web, BaltimoreChefShop.com. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.